Ladies and gentlemen, I think we should start this final panel of the Global Conference on Human Rights and Diverse Societies. It's been an extremely rich 2 days that we've had. And this panel is not really intended to draw conclusions. Conclusions probably we'll draw for ourselves, going in our mind through everything that we've learned and experienced through these few days. But we have gathered on stage persons with a vast knowledge about these issues, and there are probably words of wisdom that we can share at the end of this conference. I will not introduce them fully. I'd rather keep the time for letting them talk. You have their bios, and they speak for themselves in the program. We have with us Professor Kathleen Mahoney, Professor Boaventura de Sousa Santos, and two of the young leaders, now McGill Eckenberg Human Rights Fellows, Pema Vichen from Bhutan, and Aditi Malhotra from India. The program of this session is the following. I'll ask Kathleen Mahoney and Boaventura de Sousa Santos to speak for 20 minutes each. Then the young leaders will present us with the result of their week's work, which is a declaration, and they will have 20 minutes to do that. After that, I would like to organize, we'll have another hour, we have 2 hours together, I would like to organize for about half an hour a dialogue between the young leaders and our presenters on stage. And the last half hour will be opened to the rest of the room, if that's okay with you. The idea is to bring together and make sure that the contribution of the young leaders is heard and well heard before the end of the meeting, and to give them half an hour time to ask the questions they want to ask and make the comments they want to make will give us that, a sense at least, of everything they've done during the week. So if that's okay with everyone, maybe I'll ask Kathleen or Boa, who wants to start? We haven't decided that. Kathleen?
Sure, why not? Good. Well, first of all, I'd like to give my congratulations to Francois and all the rest of the organizers that have worked so hard to pull this amazing meeting together. And I'd also like to congratulate all you young leaders. This is fantastic, this event, and I'm very honored to be able to participate in it today and hear what you have to say. And I'm sort of a little nervous about maybe some of your questions. I hope I'll be able to respond to them, but congratulations to you too. My remarks, hopefully, will be around 15, 20 minutes, but I want to talk more about theory today. But first of all, conferences like this are very, very important. It's apparent from the perspectives, I didn't get to attend all of the sessions, but it's apparent from the perspectives, as I've been told, that were given during the last couple of days, that people have different views as to whether the world has moved forward or backward with respect to honoring and protecting basic human rights. On the one hand, virtually no government today claims to be unaccountable to the world community for human rights violations. Thousands of NGOs at the global level, as well as local organizations, consistently report on human rights abuses, and their work does command attention. There's no doubt about that. National and regional courts, both human rights courts, constitutional courts, and regular high courts, have consistently upheld many human rights claims. And what was spoken about here today is that courts have upheld, in particular the European Court of Human Rights, has strongly upheld the prohibition on torture. And as was also pointed out during the conference, more and more states around the world are getting rid of the death penalty. Important also is the fact that More and more minorities are finding their way into significant positions of power, or at least symbolic positions in governments. And also, it was pointed out, and of course we all celebrate the fact that the United States elected a black president by the name of Barack Hussein Obama, something which never would have been contemplated 10 years ago. So there have been significant advances in different ways, which give us some room to be optimistic about human rights. On the other hand, however, the moral consensus that sustained the Universal Declaration since 1948, especially over the last 15 years or so, I think one can say quite safely that that has significantly broken down. Since 9/11 in particular, some have even questioned whether the era of human rights has come to an end. For example, it was pointed out that countries all over the world, including our own here in Canada, but the United States, China, Egypt, Russia, Indonesia, Sudan, Australia, all have used the war against terrorism to cloak their own human rights abuses and further their own goals that are not necessarily connected at all to the threat of terrorism. Since 9/11, national security interests have justified the most egregious violations of human rights, including torture, detention without trial, targeted killings, and detention and prosecution of child soldiers and the like. Extreme religious groups severely compromise the equality, liberty, security, health, and education rights of women and children in the name of culture and religion. To deal with these problems, on the one hand, cultural relativism has become a mechanism to, in my opinion, avoid dealing with the tough problems. And on the other hand, states clumsily pass laws dictating what religious practices are acceptable in the public sphere, often targeting nonviolent, moderate groups in the name of national cohesion. In Canada, where we have strong human rights and charter protections for equality of women, there is a culture of impunity around violence against Indigenous women. The abductions, rapes, and murders of Indigenous women in Canada occurs in shocking numbers as compared to the same crimes against women of other racial backgrounds. These are the contradictions people are struggling to understand, and their existence helps to explain why human rights advocates are facing resistance from all sides, not the least of which is on the very notion of universality. If moving forward and making moral progress is still an option and a goal of the international community, and I hope it is for our young leaders, it will require careful thought about what do we wish to achieve and how do we proceed. I came across this quote from Aung San Suu Kyi that is inspirational in this regard. She said, "Many years of house arrest afforded much time and food for thought. I came to the conclusion that the human race is not divided into two opposing camps of good and evil. It is made up of those who are capable of learning and those who are incapable of doing so. As we strive to teach others, we must have the humility to acknowledge that we still have much to learn, and we must have the flexibility to adapt to the changing needs of the world around us." Bearing her advice in mind, the conference organizers asked me to consider some questions in the preparation of my remarks. And two of the questions, as I mentioned at the outset, I would like to focus on. One is, are human rights correctly theorized? Or what is missing in the mainstream discourse of human rights to take into account some aspects of human diversity? Now, most people assume that they and everyone else knows what they mean by human rights. However, I believe this is an incorrect assumption. Many of us have different conceptions and interpretations of human rights, and sometimes they are not compatible with the views of others. If we cannot be clear from the outset what we mean by human rights, then the remainder of our analysis will inevitably be flawed. Two conceptions or theories of human rights commonly surface in discussions about human rights. These I will label the essentialist version and the critical modernist version. The essentialist version, which has its roots in the 17th century, is underpinned by the idea that there is something about being human that gives us an entitlement to basic human rights. The core of this theory is that human rights transcend the contingencies of politics. Now, this is an attractive theory because it is a universal one. And the generalization this allows in the conversation about human rights is desirable. But unfortunately, there are serious problems associated with this theory. The first problem is its abstraction and lack of specificity. While this may also be its greatest strength, it is also its greatest weakness. Because of its vagueness, there is a lack of consensus as to what the nature and parameters of these basic rights are or may be. The second problem is that the universal human rights discourse is not really relevant for most people. The emphasis on rights means very little to those who do not have enough to eat, they can't drink clean water, they don't experience decent housing or adequate health care, or whose rapes and murders are not investigated by the police. Until these needs are met, they cannot even contemplate exercising their rights in a court of law or before a human rights commission. The third problem with the universalistic approach is that it assumes there is and should be a core norm to measure human rights against. We commonly see this problem surface in the mass media's treatment of minorities. If the minority group in question does not embrace core universalistic norms, they are often portrayed as somehow deviant and to be feared, marginalized, ridiculed, or ignored. As a result, objective analysis in the press, its accuracy and fairness in dealing with minority issues, are compromised by the use of stereotypes, generalizations, or portrayals that misrepresent the character and cultural values of these groups. This is always harmful and can cause lasting damage to their place in society and also lasting damage to the cohesion of the society in which they exist. On the other hand, there is the conception of human rights, which I will call the critical view, that understands that human rights are not static and cannot be essentialized or predefined. It does not agree that there is a core reference point or norm to measure human rights against. Rather, non-essentialists see the subject of human rights as a construct of multitude of influences. It is a way of thinking, of talking, of knowing, which in turn facilitates and shapes social interaction. The central and core idea of the critical view is that human rights indeed are an element of politics and therefore are within the terrain of political struggle. Those who have traditionally and historically been excluded from the human rights conversation, indigenous peoples, women, and minorities, largely hold the non-essentialist or critical view. Those who hold the traditional essentialist view tend to be human rights insiders or elites. The clash between these two theoretical perspectives was evident at this conference and has been evident in this country for quite some time. The result is that debates on human rights, diversity, and equality often end in dismay, hurt feelings, anger, and frustration on both sides. Even if there is some shared understanding about human rights, about what human rights mean in a multicultural and diverse society, it is difficult to apply human rights and human rights values and principles in a way that satisfies all cultural groups. We have to accept that. When human rights are viewed through a political prism, though, as opposed to being assumed to be above politics, space does open for a different debate to take place. As politics are about power and domination, and if human rights are about politics, the debate can be reformulated to ask, how can human rights be used to break down the hierarchy of domination and subordination? This type of questioning highlights responsibilities and opportunities as opposed to analyzing whether or not any given cultural or religious practice adheres to a fixed normative standard. This broader debate is significant in at least three ways. First, it does not allow human rights to be reduced or restricted to a pseudo-determinative idea such as, for example, liberty. Instead, it requires the human rights discourse to be more open-ended and changeable. Second, the non-essentialist approach requires us to look at the needs of people, forcing the debate away from abstractions to consider the concrete and often messy realities of everyday life. Third, the human rights debate from the critical perspective permits power to be challenged and reconceptualized in the name of human rights. It gives space to discuss how human rights can empower or give power to. Thus, human rights can be developed as a strategy of resistance. A non-essentialist human rights advocate would therefore understand how human rights could and should be used to support the self-determinations of First Nations peoples in Canada. So why aren't we reaching a whole range of populations? Well, there's another reason, and that is related to the essentialist approach. Because since World War II, the emphasis in international law has been on individual rights. The international community accepted that individuals acting in association with other individuals could protect group interests in terms of language, religion, and culture. So the thinking went, group rights would be superfluous. It also thought that group rights could be dangerous. With this essentialist vision privileging individual human rights over collective rights, whole populations are left out. The inability of mainstream human rights discourse to fully come to terms with collective rights is symptomatic of universalism versus particularism. When it comes to groups who see their identity as more within membership in a group, universalism to them becomes a false concept. What is required is much greater sensitivity to the specific reality of differently situated people. We need to work on conceiving and developing a contextual practice of human rights, one that foregoes the idyllic, one that comes to terms with the messiness and complexity of multiple realities. For example, environmental security may mean different things whether you live in a rich North American society, whether you are an Inuit, or whether you are an indigenous person in a South American rainforest. Human rights activists should be self-reflexive enough to recognize the diversity of these realities and to respond accordingly. This may require fundamental reinterpretations of the source and nature of the problems, the type of questions asked, and the answers sought. Many suggest that in order to reach more people, to overcome differences, and to come to some accommodation of competing rights, what is needed is a sense of solidarity, and this must be cultivated and encouraged. Roberto Unger, a Latin American human rights and social theorist, says that solidarity is our feelings of responsibility for those whose lives touch in some way upon our own, and our greater or lesser willingness to share their fate. Solidarity, he says, is the social face of love. Many feminists advocate for an ethic of care, which looks like Unger's description of solidarity. They define an ethic of care as being a consciousness of the interconnection between the self and the other. Carol Gilligan and Joan Toronto say an ethic of care encourages enthusiasm for and an understanding of the needs of others and engenders a willingness to respond compassionately and responsible to those needs. The late Justice Rolf Risdell, president of the European Court of Human Rights, said that all human rights are indivisible and interdependent, but then he went on and said that solidarity at all levels is needed if it is not to just be the strong and the privileged who are able to benefit from the full enjoyment of their fundamental rights. So the ethic of care and solidarity is a kind of social morality, its central insight being an awareness of the interconnection with the self and the other. The late Chief Justice of Canada, Brian Dixon, was close to adopting the ethic of care, when he urged his judicial colleagues to practice compassionate justice, declaring compassion to be part of the nature of law itself, and that the judicial decision-making should not simply be an application of abstract rules. He said, "By compassion, I mean a feeling of empathy or sympathy for the hardships experienced by others, a feeling which extends to a sense of responsibility and concern to alleviate hardship, at least in some measure." So in answering the question, where do we go from here? What is in and what is out? Who decides? We must be careful to think about an ethic of care and solidarity before making those choices. One thing I wanted to mention, but we must be careful, I must speak as a lawyer and a law professor here, we have to be careful as well about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Human rights tribunals have in the past and continue to play a fundamental role in our society. A simplistic rejection of the more traditional styles of justice is neither warranted nor practical, and law's place as the core framework around which change can take place is assured and should be assured. But there's no doubt that national justice systems, human rights commissions, and other administrative tribunals are often too aloof, overwhelmed with work, or otherwise incapable of responding properly to people's needs. Human rights institutions should become flexible enough to encompass the experience of local victims and communities. Outreach, education, storytelling, and mobilization of women's groups can broaden ownership and involvement in historically elite-driven processes. Direct involvement of grassroots organizations and social movements can broaden the gaze of lawmakers and decision makers. Narrow positivistic justice that is the norm in most countries emphasizes the formal or instrumental aspects of a legal system, inclined to assume the self-evident rightness of the rule of law. People like judges, human rights commissioners, lawyers, legal academics, and others who work in or influence such institutions should be challenged and encouraged to improve what they do, to think more deeply about why they do it, and to explore ways in which these same institutions can broaden ownership and encourage participation of those who've been most directly affected by discrimination or conflict. In particular, lawyers, in my view, and this is my world, should be taught and encouraged to think more deeply and reflectively about the consequences of legalistic approaches and be more imaginative in overcoming some of those consequences. Now, in conclusion, it seems to me that a theory and practice of human rights appropriate for the future requires a new critical modernistic approach, one that challenges power over and pursues power to, one that highlights our responsibilities and our opportunities. As I've indicated, there's been tensions and controversies for a long time in our country and internationally and at this conference. People have been angry, dismayed, hurt, frustrated. But part of the reason why this is so is because people who've been traditionally excluded have gained some space, although certainly not enough, to articulate their version of human rights. The debate has been and can be painful, and I think that the human rights community has begun to listen. The task that lies ahead is to invoke the standard of self-reflexivity, to turn critique into reconstruction, to help transform rage into solidarity, and for all of us to imagine and put into effect a new relationship between life, law, and solidarity.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you, young leaders, for being here. We badly need a renewal of human rights talk and practice for three reasons. Most people in the world are objects of human rights, not subjects of human rights. They are objects of our discourses on human rights, of our NGOs, of our colloquium, of our center. Secondly, the human rights are a weak response to a strong question. The strong question is the following. How is it that in a society of abundance, technological development, and such a waste of goods and services. So million people are dying of hunger, curable diseases, malnutrition, war, violence, and slave labor. Third, historically, what counts as human and what counts as human rights violation has been quite arbitrary throughout history. Remember, in 1537, the Pope Paul III declared that indigenous people had indeed a soul. 1537. It took them 500 years to elect a president as indigenous president of a South American country, Evo Morales. I think that some hard facts, historical facts, need to be brought in order to analyze and to see the lines of renewal. The first one is the idea of teleology. That is to say, in the case of human rights, we tend to read history backwards, from the present to the past, as if everything conspired to the triumph of human rights. This is not true. The history of human rights is a very contingent history. And in fact, as contingent as the role of human rights for social emancipation. Human rights have also been an instrument of oppression, repression, discrimination throughout the world. Therefore, it is very important to neither be triumphalist nor deny these questions of contingency. Note that most of the liberation movements, independence liberation movements in Africa or in Asia, never used the concept of human rights. Very rarely were they used. Why? The third fact is the tension between the universal and the foundational. The universal, as you know, is what is important because of extension. Universal extension is representative. The universal is representative by extension. The foundational is representative by quality, by its uniqueness, by its being a unique structure. What happens with human rights is that the Western conception of human rights, which is a foundational conception, managed to become a universal conception. Not surprisingly, many other conceptions of human rights in non-Western cultures do disagree with the Western conceptions of human rights, particularly of the universalistic idea of human rights. The fourth flaw of our analysis, as usual analysis, is decontextualization. The French Revolution and the American Revolution were fought in the name of law and in the name of human rights. The Russian Revolution was the first revolution to be fought against law and against human rights. Why? Because in the meantime, law became a monopoly of the state. It was not such during the French or the American Revolution. So human rights were once part of a revolutionary process. Later on, they become part of a depoliticized conception of social transformation. And in so doing, by being depoliticized, they really addressed more the effects of structural conflicts than the causes. The causes being capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, fundamentalism. Human rights address the effects of such conflicts, not their causes. And this contextualization, in a sense, is what is troubling us. So I think that we should struggle for a counter-hegemonic use of human rights, a counter-hegemonic conception of human rights, because I've been struggling for that, and I think that it is possible to develop out of conventional human rights a counter-hegemonic human rights. And the first interesting aspect is that there's enormous difference between the theory of human rights and the practices of human rights throughout the world. And the reason is a simple one. The theory was produced in the global north. Most of the interesting transformative practices using human rights today are going on the global south. Of very different cultures, very different interests, very different positions in the world system. So this discrepancy should be addressed. And I think I distinguished two ways of moving forward in this, what I could call a paradigmatic shift. One, in fact, is a sub-paradigmatic shift, and another is a paradigmatic shift. I think the sub-paradigmatic shift is what I've been doing, in a sense, in my work, some of you may know, on multicultural conceptions of human rights. I've been trying to compare different conceptions of human dignity throughout the world, particularly the concept of human rights, the concept of Ummah in Islam, and the concept of Dharma in Hinduism, and showing the reciprocal problems of each one of them. None of them is a complete response to the questions of human dignity. And therefore, we should struggle for a more intercultural conception of human rights. Secularism, religion, post-secularism is the work in which I've been involved, and one reaches the conclusion that, in fact, religious freedom is only possible in a world free of religion. Now, a paradigmatic shift. That's what I'm trying to move a bit forward, and I'm using this opportunity to do that in my 20 minutes. It's on whenever we enrich or expand human rights, it starts by being unthinkable. It is very hard to develop a new idea on this expansion. And the expansion that I'm going to propose to you, based on the transformative constitutionalism of the countries in South America, such as Ecuador and Bolivia, from which I come from. I come from Portugal. I don't come from there. I come on my trip from there. Is that finally we are crossing the divide between the human and non-human. That is to say, here the title of my talk is the Summa Causae and the Rights of the Pachamama. Two non-colonial words to pronounce my talk. Summa causa is a Quechua word for buen vivir in Spanish, good life, good living, which is very much similar to some people that are here from India to the concept of Swadesh in Gandhi or to the Ubuntu concept in southern parts of Africa. But it is this concept of summa causa, or in Aymara, summa kamanya, the rights of the Pachamama. Pachamama is Mother Earth. And these are now, at this point, they are part of the constitutions, both in Ecuador and in Bolivia. What are we witnessing here is a paradigmatic shift, because we are moving from an anthropocentric view of human rights to a biocentric conception of human rights. Up until now, human rights are based on the human. And, of course, we have been very selective in considering what a human is. That's why slaves were not human. That's why women were not human. But in any case, it is within the human that we have been discussing. I think that now we are moving to a biocentric field, and this biocentric takes really a nature as the basic structure for our analysis. It is not nature as we conceive of it in the West. That is to say, natural resources. It's Mother Earth, it's Pachamama. Is Mother Earth is a living being, an entity to which we belong. We are not, it's not our environment. We are part of it. We belong to its cycle, to its vital cycles. And this living being is what, in fact, constitutes the roots of our rights. And whenever those rights are really transgressed, all of us are at risk. And therefore, why is it possible that indigenous people, particularly those in Ecuador and in Bolivia, and in fact in Canada, they have very much the same conception of nature? How do they come now with this conception, which is not good for indigenous people, it's good for us, it's good for everyone, the idea of a new conception of rights, which is not anthropocentric? Of course, it's based on a new constitutionalism, which is transformative, not only because it derives from large mobilizations of people, but also because it brings in these marvelous things. For the first time, our constitutions have non-colonial words in the constitution. How are you going to do, the constitutional lawyers, all the lawyers that don't master Quechua or Aymara or Urdu or Hindi or any other languages, that now they are present in their constitution? So the rights of the Pachamama, we don't have colonial words in colonial languages to express the novelty. And that's why we have to resort to words which we are unfamiliar with. And of course, this caused much discomfort in our conceptions. So the first one is, of course, is that we have to transgress the Cartesian division between body and soul, between object and subject. They are gone in this conception because nature as a living entity has an intrinsic value that is not coextensive with the value of the human utility of land, that therefore the utility of that we have of the natural resources has nothing to do with intrinsic value of nature. Is this a non-Western conception? Of course it is. But it is not just that. We had in the West also conceptions very similar to us. Some of you that master philosophy here would see that concept of nature in Spinoza, Deus sive natura, in Latin. I mean, it's very much the concept of nature in the Pachamama. And, Schopenhauer was one that, in fact, followed the Hindu tradition to bring in within the Western philosophy this conception. What happened is that the conquest made a caricature out of the richness of the Western modernity. All the conceptions of Western modernity that didn't serve the conquest were sidelined, were put aside, were eliminated. That's why Pascal was eliminated. That's why Montaigne was eliminated. That's why Spinoza were eliminated. They were not good for the missionaries and for the conquest. And therefore, it is not surprising now that after all this conception of human rights, which purports to be universal, is very, indeed very particular. Is particularly in the West, it is particularly when we look around the world and see the experiences of people, how they conceive of nature, how they conceive of rights. And finally, we may meet this new conception with very old conceptions. And in fact, Gaia hypothesis by Lovelock, in a sense, through the development of science, we reach very much the same conclusion, an alternative vision of evolution, in which evolution is not like Spencer wanted based on competition, but on cooperation, the cooperation of microorganisms of which we are part. And therefore, we see today that the world is still divided in between two types of people, people that own land and people that belong to land. And this is one of the major differences in our world. So there are, of course, precedents for these innovations, precedents that have been, throughout the world in the Middle Ages. I mean, you can imagine in the Middle Ages, pigs were tried. there were punishment against pigs. So there was something human about them. There were other worlds that we don't know, but these, in fact, existed. So, and the Sierra Club case, you know, do streets have standing? And the celebrated case of the 70s about the protection of the trees in California. So this is not completely new. What is completely new now is that this is in a constitution as a very broad structure of our constitution with very, very important consequences. And first of all, the consequence is that these rights of the Pachamama, of this Mother Earth, are based and anchored on a new economy, political economy, which is not capitalism, cannot be capitalism. It's the solidarity that Kathleen was talking about. It's a reciprocity, complementarity, other forms of life and economic life that we, in fact, are experienced throughout the world. This does not imply that we are not going to exploit nature, no. We are going to use natural resources to the extent that we respect their rights, their intrinsic rights to have their vital cycle restored, regenerated, and not destroyed. And this, in my view, is what is new about this new paradigmatic change in which we are trying. What are the consequences? Well, I'll give you just a couple of examples. You will see the type of line that we are pursuing and to what a great extent is unknown. And We should pursue it in a way that, in fact, we transform in the West. That's what we have to do. Unthink our conceptions in order to make room for other conceptions, which, after all, are much more common than we think. They are very universal in this small corner of the world that we call the global north. First of all, an explored ecosystem or an exploited ecosystem has no economic value for us. For conventional economics, if the ecosystem is not explored or exploited, there's no economic value. Change that. We have to see the value of something that is not explored. Secondly, there is no value in doing nothing in capitalism. We have to learn how to strike a value, find a value in doing nothing. If a river is contaminated, and there are many, many rivers contaminated throughout the world, and the countries from where I come from, through the oil exploitation, do you know how the compensation is calculated? It's calculated by the price of the fish that is not going to be fished during, a couple of years. Well, this is not a compensation, because a compensation, again, following the rights of nature, is a compensation for the full restoration and regeneration of the ecosystem that has been destroyed, because that ecosystem has an intrinsic value of itself. Third, if indigenous people in Chile, Mapuche people, they block roads, and of course they are considered terrorists because the entire terrorist laws are being used in Latin America to incriminate all the indigenous leaders that block the roads and prevent the machines to enter the territories, because they are sacred territories and the entire terrorism laws that apply to them. Well, if they block the roads according to the rights of nature, it's self-defense. Because nature has rights, and we have here a system of tutorship, of trusteeship also, according to different systems, and therefore it's an act of self-defense. So the impact on use of land is tremendous. We, of course, go on owning land, but what about transgenic organisms, mega projects, monoculture, soybeans, monoculture, new conditionalities that we have to bring together, another conception of food sovereignty, the prohibition of patents on life. That's what we have at stake. We have to start prohibiting, patenting life. And as you know, lots of patents are already out there. They don't belong to humans. They belong to the intrinsic rights of nature. So I could give you an example, but probably in the debate, because I'm about to finish my 20 minutes, of how the people in South America are trying to implement in very precise terms what the rights of nature are. And the examples are very important. One of them, just one of them, is the fact that the project called Yasun ITT. Yasun is the largest park in biodiversity in the world, and Ecuador is offering the world community not to explore the oil that is underneath that land, provide that the developed countries compensate Ecuador for half of the revenues that is going not to have because of not exploiting the oil. And believe me, Germany has already volunteered to pay 50 million euros per year during 13 years. This is post-Kyoto. It's not remedies to prevent contamination by moving from an oil-based industry to a non-oil-based title. A word on title and standing. I know that you, but how can land, how can nature has rights because of the standing and because of the rights and duties? So lawyers will come with all kinds of theories. It will take some time before they come to terms with this reality. But I conclude with the following ideas. First of all, it is not in any way forbidden to use nature, but use respectfully, because nature communicates with us. And if we don't know, climate change is probably a way in which nature is communicating to us. The rights of nature is, of course, for lawyers now, it will be a delight. is a legal hybrid, as I have been calling them in my work, because as you can imagine, nature has no rights, because for the cosmovision of indigenous people, Pachamama is the source of rights. It's as absurd to speak of rights of nature as it is to speak of rights of God. But here we have a hybrid. Rights coming from the Western conception of rights, and nature coming from the indigenous conceptions and cosmovisions. This is, in my view, a legal hybrid. And of course, this is a civilizatory threshold. We are entering a new age of limits, thresholds, groundings, linkages. There are concepts that we have to abandon. Development was involved, was invented to create underdevelopment, so that on the following day after the invention of development, most of the people in the world, most of the countries, were underdeveloped. And so were their laws, and so were their culture, and so were their customs. That was the idea behind the idea of development. And in so doing, I think that my final word, since I don't have time to go on to explain a little bit more this, it is, after all, quite evident. I mean, as all the innovations, political innovations, are evident after the fact, as in fact Sartre used to say, is that if you look at most of the violence against nature, I mean, the mega projects, for instance, the open sky type of mining, they, of course, are violences against the people that live there. Look at the Adivasi in India. How many millions of people have been displaced by these mega projects? That is to say, in order to protect the human beings, we have to protect nature according to their specific value. If you don't protect one, you are not going to protect anyone of them. Thank you.
These were very inspirational words, and it gives us food for thought, and it sort of traces avenues for the future. It's a bit hazy where it leads, but we know that there are paths there that we are going to have to walk. I now invite the young leaders to tell us what they have to say.
Distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, Kusuzangpo, greetings in my language. May I take this moment to thank the two extremely great and speakers and panelists for their enriching insights. It is probably safe to say that I've traveled the longest distance to be here today. Penny and Gordon has probably paid the most amount of money for my plane tickets to be friends with me when they could have done it on Facebook. However, after 1 week, they've told us that we are not just friends, but the new members of the Eckenberg family. And we are very happy to assume this new status. We are young people representing 24 different nations, that include Honduras, Yemen, Greece, Armenia, Russia, Canada, Bosnia, Macedonia, Australia, Romania, Uzbekistan, Belarus, Denmark, the United States, Colombia, Ghana, Germany, Afghanistan, Brazil, Republic of Georgia, Indonesia, Nepal, Kenya, India, and Bhutan. Growing up in such a wide range of cultures, our values and beliefs may be different, but we are united by our passion. A passion to see a better world for both our people and our shared humanity. This week in the city of Montreal and on the Mohawk land, we have come to know each other and forged lifelong bonds. We have discussed and disagreed. We have argued and we have individually been challenged. However, we have reached a common consensus and produced a statement that reflects our common aspirations. Now I will ask my fellow young leaders to share with you what we have.
2010 Eckenberg Fellows Call to Action. We are young people from diverse societies who have met in Montreal for a conference on human rights and diverse societies in October 2010. We have multiple identities, come from different contexts, and have experienced various forms of conflicts. Together, we believe that commitment to the furtherance of human rights is crucial to a peaceful and harmonious future for all. Despite numerous conventions and declarations, abuses are still continuing, and the impact of globalization highlights the urgent need for a new discourse on human rights, which respects and acknowledges existing and emerging realities facing our diverse societies. We thus state that the existing concepts and understandings of human rights are inadequately defined and do not ensure optimal human rights protection and, as such, require continued review and reform. We underline the importance of responding to the voices of the diverse and powerless people. Our diverse experiences and interactions with each other have reaffirmed to us that human rights have different expressions in different contexts and that they are ever evolving. Defining them must have regard for diverse peoples and cultures and be an ongoing process reviewed globally and locally. Thus, we have 5 statements reaffirming our shared beliefs.
To reimagine the construct of human rights by changing language and discourse to reflect and incorporate diversity.
We need to recognize that human rights are not solely the responsibility of states, but also of individuals, groups, corporations, and peoples.
We need to recognize people's freedom to self-identification individually and collectively.
We need to give people the knowledge and means to challenge power.
We are impatient for change. We want to be part of it. We want you to be part of it.
We would now like to thank Professor Francis Kipu, who impressed us with his very diverse collection of postal bags from all around the world. And to Joris, you are our favorite Kiwi. Without your inspiration and guidance, the statement would not have been what it is. To Ellen Hemu, thank you for making all the travel arrangements. I'm sure it must have been a great challenge. To Nandini, without you, this conference would not have been possible, and us, young leaders, would not have been able to forge the life-lasting friendship. To Molly and Ariella, we recognize that you had some problems with our different concepts of being on time, but at least we made it here to Montreal. We are very grateful for the time and effort that you have put in into organizing this conference, and to your small army of McGill students, law students, volunteers, who have helped to ensure that we felt at home. Can I now please have Nandini, Molly, and Ariel on stage?
I think that Nandini, Molly and Ariella didn't know that this was going to happen, and we have been. Okay. Well, someone has gone to fetch them.
we have these flowers for them to show our appreciation and love. you could have Molly first. I think it's our fault we didn't inform them. So can we have Molly on behalf of them to receive the flowers?
Yeah. Okay, good.
just so that we keep into the time constraint, the Canadian time constraint.
Absolutely.
To Penny and Gordon, we begin this conference learning how to build a dream catcher. And we ended up today affirming to you that each of us have dreams for ourselves, our community, and this world. We present the both of you with a dream catcher made by Nick, not only to thank you, but to remind you, that all of us are bound together like the reeds we have woven. We trust that our presence here has enabled you to take one more step towards your dream. And expanding the network of young committed advocates for human rights. Thank you so much. In my language, I would like to say it. Kadinche, namisami kadinche. That is, thank you beyond the sky and the earth.
We still have work to do. Thank you. Thank you very much, Pima. We still have work to do.
I think if you have any question for the young leaders, then I'm sitting here, but we are a team, so anyone can, answer from the group.
What I would like to do, if possible, I would like to start a discussion between the young leaders and the panelists. We have, let's say, 55 minutes. We can take about half of that for a discussion. Can we bring the mics to the young leaders on both sides? I think these are mics that don't have a cord. Let's bring the mics forward and let the young leaders ask questions, make comments on what you've heard today and in the past 2 days.
Professor,
yes?
With your permission, may I join the young leaders now?
Yes, please do that. Perfect. And we can take 25, 30 minutes for that. And I would like you to be able to voice your questions, your comments, your concerns, reacting to what we've heard today, to what we've done in the past 2 days, to what you've done for the past week. And then we'll open the floor to the rest of the public, and we'll have a larger discussion.
Good afternoon. My name is Joanna. I'm from Brazil. I'd like to ask Professor Kathleen Mahoney, how can we integrate groups' rights to self-determination and women and LGBT rights? And can I ask one question? To
yes,
each,
go ahead. We'll take probably several questions, comments.
Okay. To Professor Boaventura de Souza Santos, over the past week we've been discussing conceptions of states that are both secular and religious. We've been trying to reconcile secular ideas of individual freedoms, the focus on the time here on Earth, the rule of law, the supremacy of state-made norms, on one hand, and on the other hand, religious states and cultural groups that claim these ideas are Western values. They stress community rights to maintain tradition, even when they conflict human individual rights, with an emphasis on the time hereafter, and which claim the superiority of other forms of norms. So, You mentioned, I quote, "Religious freedom is only possible in a world free of religion." I would like to ask, in this context, does it mean a defense of a secular state, and wouldn't it further alienate all the religious states and all the other groups based on different ideas of norm hierarchies, time, and etc.? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other question or comment? Please, we'll take three, maybe. Diversity.
Thank
yeah.
you. I just have a quick question. My name is Jakob. I'm from Denmark. Both of you, thank you, by the way, for wonderful presentations. They're very inspiring. Both of you talk about how we need to question and challenge the current discourse on human rights, and especially, excuse me, Professor Mahoney, many of the points that you mentioned, I thought, reminded me of first of all, the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, mm-hmm. and perhaps more specifically how that's started now to being incorporated into the whole discourse on right to development and rights-based development. And I recently read a book by Irene Khan, the former Secretary General of Amnesty International. I think she makes a very, very compelling argument for how you can actually use economic and social and cultural rights in courtrooms and in traditional avenues of justice, exactly to ensure, as you mentioned, that people have full stomachs before they, or not, perhaps making the distinction that they don't have to have full stomachs before they can think about rights, but that their full stomachs is part of them thinking of their rights, and then so it can perhaps be kept within the traditional court system and law-based system of pursuing human rights, but that we can expand our understanding of that, what that means, mm-hmm. And perhaps start to take the economic, social, and cultural covenant more seriously, perhaps especially just north of the border, south of the border here in the U.S., but also other places in the world. So I'd just love to hear your thoughts on whether you think the economic, social, and cultural rights can be used within the current framework we have of international law and human rights in particular. Thanks.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Kwong Lee. I'm from the United States. The question actually is for both speakers, but wanted to revisit a quote that Speaker Mahoney had mentioned about Aung San Suu Kyi, about in terms of education and those who are educated and uneducated. And I think being here at the conference, one of the things I've recognized is the fact that, you know, you look at everybody's bios, everyone's well-educated, and people bring a lot to the table. But I'm worried in the world that we've created that these institutions have ulterior motives. And the more we get educated, the more of the mind frames that we've developed. And so as the panel and the conference is about diversity being religious diversity, I've noticed that it's centered on a lot of what has been the political atmosphere of the world, where it's debates about Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And there isn't a lot of mention of other beliefs. And I think education in the ways that we've been brought up and have been educated, where some have been given those privileges and others have not, have been part of the problem of how we address those issues. So if you can talk about that, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the thoughtful comments and questions. Professor de Souza Santos, to change the order.
Thank you.
Give you more time.
Well, to our Brazilian young leader, well, this is part of the conflicts that we have in our society and in the world in general, is between the types of values to which we give priority. And that's what we usually call conflict of values within the Kantian tradition. But the Kantian tradition is very complex. In a sense, even today, when we go back to those traditions of conflicts, and the reason is that in order to have a kind of a hierarchy of values. You have to have some common principles. And in fact, it is today almost impossible to identify those common principles. That is to say, I think that the diversity of the world is inexhaustible. And if it is inexhaustible, there is no general theory that can account for that. Nor Western, nor non-Western. So we don't need universalism. We need a kind of a negative universalism. That is to say, a universal idea about the impossibility of a general theory. Nobody has the recipes for changing things once and for all and for everyone in the world. And therefore, this is the principle through which we should aim at what we call democratic pluralism. Of course, we know that immediately in our tradition the question of relativism comes. And it's a paralyzing question. Because once you are involved in struggles, in real struggles, and we cannot have these discussions outside the struggles, quite frankly. Once you are in the struggles, you know that you cannot afford to be a relativist. Because the struggle is out there. You know who the enemy is. You know who is damaging your life, who is destroying your life, who is producing violence. Therefore, relativism is not an issue in concrete questions. What it is at issue, of course, is the types of values that you bring into that discussion. And some of them bring religious values, other secular values. And what we have been pleading for is what we call intercultural translation. It is impossible to force everyone to use the same language in the world. There are different languages for human dignity. There was really, for instance, in the tradition of critical theory, we had always this idea that either we are socialists or we are capitalists. Well, if you work with indigenous peoples in Latin America or the Adivans in India or the peasants in Africa, as I do, you'll see that many of them, and they are very revolutionary people very often, they don't name their struggles in terms of socialism. In Latin America, they name their struggles in name of respect, dignity, self-government, territory. These are their words. Why shouldn't they count on the same foot as the kind of socialism or any other? If you go to these villages where the indigenous people or Afro-descendant village in your country now, Afro-Brazilian, the Quilombos communities, which are so rich at this point and so active at this point, they have their own conceptions, of course, and they bring in other forms which, in fact, we cannot conceive because we tend to be dualistic. Since we lost Spinoza and gained Cartesian. That is to say, we are either secular or we are religious. There are things that are neither secular nor religious. The concept, for instance, of spirituality. It's not religion. It's a concept of something that is not immanent, that is transcendent. This is not a religion. The fact that the ancestors, when we are in a meeting, the ancestors are together with us. This is a spirituality. It's not a religion. Their presence transcends the imminent physical presence of people. Of course, we cannot conceive. I could tell you thousands of stories of my work in which ministers and executives and so on don't understand, and they really cannot discuss or have a deliberation with ancestors. How could they? Coming from the Western culture. But the elderly people in those communities can do so. So I think that in terms of the variety of values that can be conveyed in the struggle, I can recommend to you, you know, it's just because the The paper is published in an electronic journal published by Warwick University in the UK. It's a paper that I recommend if you want to read. It's a paper I wrote. It's called "If God Were a Human Rights Activist," and you'll see there some of these questions. Of course, you were shocked by my idea that religious freedom is only valid or possible in a world free of religion. It of course, everything depends on what I think about free of religion. The free of religion may be one thing in the West, may be another thing in the East, because the freedom of religion is the multiplicity of religions in some place. It's not a void, it's not a negative thing. It's the plurality of deities. And Hinduism, for instance, teaches us lots of things about democratic religiosity that we don't have. With, of course, other problems, which I discuss in other papers, and if there are people here familiar with Hinduism, they will see them. So I think that in the West at this point, in the West, I think, if you want to have a religious freedom, we have to take, according to our traditions, which we cannot solve from one day to the next, we have to have a social pact on a society free of religion. That is to say, we have to defend layers of society. This is the discussion that Habermas has been taking, and is a very dilemmatic one. Religions in the privacy, not in the public sphere. Well, you know, secularism is much stronger in France than it in the United States. You know, the Portuguese president could never say "God bless Portugal" because it would be considered too religious for our taste. So there are different conceptions of this. But I see a problem here, and I think that we have to free religion in order to be free of religion. For those that want to be free of religion. For Denmark, the colleague from Denmark asks these questions. Of course we can, and we should. The convention, I mean, this the Convention of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights is our most magnificent piece of wishful thinking. And we in the West, we have that. I mean, and Thomas Aquinas was the most brilliant in denouncing that, and denounced that very, very early Middle Ages, when he said that we were really framed by the habitus principiorum. Habitus principiorum was the principle, the habit of principles. That is to say, we pronounce principles so frequently, so obsessively, in order not to comply with them in practice. And that's what we have. All presidents, all governments, and so on, is this habitus principiorum. The conventions, you know, tragically speaking, and trying to see things not from the global north, but from the global south. I come from the south of global north, but I've been unthinking my own theories in order to learn other theories and other understandings of the world. And if you look at them, of course, they will say, yes, why not? Why it has taken so long to do that? But then we'll see how difficult it will be. And what is the obstacle? Well, we know. Capitalism. Period. Colonialism. Social economic rights. Up until 2 years ago, we thought that Europe was the most secure land for social and economic rights. I had a cut in my salary of 3% without my consent from one day to the other. Who ordered it? The IMF. In Europe, European Union, our rights are being taken away. In the global north. Can you imagine what is going on in the global south? Of course, that's neoliberalism. That's the erosion of rights, because labor for capitalism is just a force of production. There's no family, there's no culture, there's no leisure, there's nothing. That was a period in the 20th century, which is now being reverted. That's why we need a new paradigm. That's why we need a new beginning. Because the most secured sites of the world are the most vulnerable now. This is a shock in Europe, and in fact the response is the most negative one. I'm ashamed of being European now through the politics that are being entertained against migrant workers in Europe. It is shameless what we are going against the Roma people from Romania and from Bulgaria. They are European citizens, sent home like animals. They are deported, children, infants, maybe deposited for 18 months in kinds of prisons. This is Europe. So it's not really nice what's going on in this field. USA, well, since you asked the board speaker, well, you know, education. Well, I have been educated as you are. I think I'm very well educated. I got my PhD at Yale, and you can say, one could say, well, I was well educated. But education is a principle, is a way of knowing and a way of ignoring. Is a system by which you know lots of people in the same process that we ignore lots of people. And if you come from other culture, from other countries, university is going to be a systematic way of making you ignorant about your culture, about the ways of life. I'll tell you a story. I was doing my research in Colombia, and one of my assistants in research was an Arhuaco, an indigenous woman from the Santa Madre, from the mountains of Colombia, the Andean. And she came to my office crying. And I said, "What? Why are you crying?" "Well, Professor, I'm coming from the contracts course." And she was first year law school at one of the elitistic school of law schools in Colombia, University of Los Andes. "Why are you crying?" "Well, I was in the class of contracts, and the professor was telling us about land, about mobile, immobile things that we sell and we buy, and so on. And land can be transactions, and so on. All the kinds of things that we can do with land, and so on." And I raised my hand and said, "Professor, in my community, it's not like that. Because we don't own land. We belong to land. Land does not belong to us. We belong to the land." And he said, "I'm teaching the civil code. I don't care about that." And she arrived in my office crying. So she was being made ignorant of her communal ways of understanding. And I said, "Look, you know more than your professor, because you are going to be an intercultural lawyer, because you know the new system, the Eurocentric system of law, and you are going not to forget your ancestral system of law. So you will be bi-juridical, so to say, as John Berger says. So you'll be legal pluralism. We are at the core of the topic here. So I think that we have to understanding that, so that's why in our process of education, we have to have our own ways of uneducating ourselves, by bringing really other realities, because the other thing of capitalism, of the way you live, not just, I mean, in the 12th century when we founded the Bologna University, it's always like that. Produce revolutionary ideas in reactionary institutions.
Kathleen?
Well, I've just been enjoying listening. I wasn't thinking about answering. I think I'll start with Mr. Lee first and work my way back the other way, because you asked about education. I'm an educator, and I think a lot about these things. And your question also reminded me of a comment that Michael Ignatieff made. I don't know if you know Mr. Ignatieff, but he's the leader of the opposition in Canada. But when he was a professor at Harvard, he wrote a book on truth commissions. And why he said that the worth of truth commissions is essentially that they limit the range of permissible lies. And to me, sometimes education can work that way or it can work the opposite way. And my talk today was about critical thinking, essentially, and being open rather than closed. And education can go either way. And I think what's really important about education is that the students have that in mind. I think that they should question everything. Just as you've questioned human rights, and you've done a very admirable job of setting that out in your declaration, you can't take anything for granted. And then I think the other point is that there's educators all around you. They're just not professors necessarily, or your parents, or your preacher if you go to church, or people like that. There's educators all around you, and I think the concept of pluralism and diversity and so on is that we open our minds to other people's truths, and that's the truly educated person. It isn't necessarily a person with 5 or 6 degrees behind their name. It's a person who is willing to listen and hear other perspectives, and not just hear them, but take them on board and practice them and incorporate them into their thinking and in their values. So I think education is a very big word. And there's formal education, and that's a small part of it. It's not as elegant an answer as my colleague here, but in any event, we'll go with that. Now, the student from Denmark, you asked about economic, social, and cultural rights, and said that you, from your perspective, you saw them starting to be incorporated. And I think you're, where are you? I think you're exactly correct. I think that that is a vehicle, the Economic, Social, and Rights Convention, to satisfy some of the things that have been spoken about here. The reality is that it has remained aspirational as opposed to being mandatory. And so therefore, when something is aspirational, people don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I think there is a wealth of information there, and I'm certainly not one to say that all the work that's been done over the last several decades of putting together these conventions and the thinking and everything is all for naught. I think that there's been some incredibly good work done, and I don't think that anything I've said today means that you just push that away and start afresh. I think that would be foolish in the extreme. So I think we look at what's there, but then the challenge is to figure out why this isn't being implemented. What is it about where we live, whether it's in our town or our village or our country, that is preventing us from moving forward in this area of economic, social, and cultural rights? And usually the answer it can be found in the other things we've been talking about over these last 2 days, the prejudices and discrimination and the lack of acknowledgement of people and their identity and where they're coming from. So I think that is a hopeful area for future development. I know that sounds somewhat trite, but I mean that the work has been done, the values are there. What needs to be done is to move that forward. And in your declaration, it sounds like that's exactly what you young people are looking forward to doing. So I think that's terrific. But I do think that's the direction that can be taken through the guidance that's in that convention. Now, the first question, the young lady from Brazil, she asked, how can we integrate group rights, women's rights, and LGBT rights? Well, I think the answer sort of incorporated in everything I've said so far is that LGBT rights are not specifically mentioned, as far as I know, in many documents anywhere. So, but they do come under sexual orientation to a certain degree. They do come under gender anti-discrimination provisions and so on. I think that LGBT rights haven't been specifically protected because people don't know a whole lot about that. And I think this is, again, part of the reality of the world that we live in. That's part of the reality of diversity. And people should know about that. There should be education about that. You should talk about that. You should make demands about that. And I don't think those voices have been heard. And with a more open, critical approach to rights, I mean, that's exactly the area where those rights should be developed and understood. Women's rights, well, again, we've got, as my colleague here was saying, there's all sorts of things written on paper. There's no magic in writing something down. There's any right any woman could probably ever want, and the in the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, but most of countries of the world do not honor that convention. And what it takes is women like yourselves and future leaders to demand that women's rights are on the agenda and that you live women's rights, that women are appointed in positions of power. Women are encouraged to take leadership roles. Women don't stand for violence against women. They take a position. I think those are the kinds of things that advance rights. It's ordinary people every day on the ground deciding how they're going to behave, who they're going to respect, and how they're going to be inclusive in the way they conduct their lives. So my view about universalism is that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's fundamental values there that are useful, but they must be interpreted. Interpretation is everything. They must be interpreted in the places where you live, in your region, your area of the world, your community, whether it's a collective community or a community that is more interested in protecting individual rights. This is where these rights have to flourish and grow in their own context and in their own way, which makes sense for the local people that want them. So that's my response.
Excellent. Yes, you can come to the microphone, but I'll invite the rest of the audience to come to the microphones as well, if you so wish. That includes everyone, including the young leaders. But go ahead.
My name is Damir Hadžić. I come from Bosnia. I thank you both for very inspirational speeches. Basically, this madam, you mentioned power and relationship, how human rights now have come to a stage where they might be changing the equality in the world. A couple of years ago in Bosnia, I bought a DVD of a British comedy show. And it was there was a comment in the DVD in the film that said, two people were talking. In Tibet, when you get something, you have to give something away. And then there was the laughter behind everything, and we all laughed. Everything was really funny to us. But this brings me to this question of how do we, after, this is probably not the result of my mind, this is the result of my being brought up, my education, my experiences, and then the influence to which I've been put to in Bosnia by buying this DVD that I have received. How can we use human rights to balance power around the world? This is, and to you, Professor, if I may, your speech has been extremely inspirational. I wish us leaders could have come up with that. I think that would be quite exceptional.
In time.
But we didn't. But it's very idealistic. I cannot see it now. Maybe I hope I would. A critical mass developing that can do what you wish for something, what you wish to be done. So my question to you is, how do you see, what action need be taken to reach this critical mass? Thank you very much.
I don't want to rain on any parades, and I found both speeches very inspirational, very challenging. But it does occur to me that within the framework of critical thinking and questioning everything, and being willing to question everything, it's important to move from what's undoubtedly true, that it's possible to reify concepts like human rights, to legitimate unthinking individualism and instrumentality, to asking about the deconstruction itself. In other words, deconstruction is only useful if it admits of its own deconstruction and if it's willing to turn the analysis on itself, because otherwise, when I hear solidarity, an important term, and I hear nature, important terms and values and critical concepts, for solidarity, I hear blood. For nature, I hear soil. And I risk finding myself reduced to a 21st century version of 19th century Russian mystical reactionary theory.
It's okay, as you wish.
An almost universal phenomenon is the one where many young people claim that many of their elders don't practice that which they preach. And so I would ask our young people today, what is it that they haven't seen from those of us who are interested in human rights and who talk about it, but who haven't done very much about it? What would they like to see us do? Specifically, not just generally.
Good question.
Hello, my name is Areli from Honduras. I'd like to ask you something.
From where?
Last year
from
we had a coup, right?
US?
And then civil society became divided, totally divided. And then it was difficult for me, because I work with torture victims, to know the border or the limit in which rights are violated and which not. Because, for instance, it was the teachers, the major group, who was on resistance on the streets. So the other side of that, I mean, the right wing, they said, yeah, but they are violating kids' rights because they are not teaching. So kids need have the right of education. But in the other side, they were saying, yeah, but we need, I mean, we have the right to resist and to protest, but we have a coup. And we were under some de facto government. So they were, they wanted to force teachers to go back to classes and give classes. But then we were saying, yeah, but we have the right to protest, and we had the right also to go against a coup. So it was so difficult for me to understand which rights were violated in that regard, because, yeah, of course, teachers were not giving classes, so the kids were not receiving classes. So the education was not given, so it was a violated right, but on the other hand, it was all the civil society, democracy was broken. I mean, it was like something very huge. So it's kind of difficult, even so far, to realize which rights were violated in that regard. Yeah.
Thank you.
Kathleen, you want to start this time?
Okay.
Oh, one more?
One more?
Yeah, one more.
Hello, I'm Caroline from Germany. I'd just like to respond to the gentleman who just asked us young leaders a question on what what people could do.
Go ahead.
And I think it is exactly what the gentleman just did, is namely taking part in conferences like this, in asking the question, what could they do? And in talking to young people and to people of all ages, what they think they could do. And by that, you're taking action. You're not just thinking about it, but you're actually taking action. So thank you.
It's very good.
Well, I'll start with, I don't know if I can answer them all, but I'll try my best. On the young man from Bosnia, he asked, how can we use human rights to balance the human rights situation around the world? I think, am I capturing it?
The balance power.
And, essentially, what I was trying to talk about in my presentation was changing the way we think about human rights as being not apolitical, as being political. If human rights are political, then human rights are about power. And if it's a violation of human rights to disempower or to take away power of people, and I'm thinking a very good example here would be First Nations in this country, and if that was recognized as a violation of human rights, well, then those people who are being subordinated in that way have a human rights claim to make, because their power has been taken away. They've been disempowered by the actions of others. It's a matter of recharacterizing how we think about human rights. If we think just about individual rights, in the example I've given you, where a whole group of people, because of their race and because of their history, have been disempowered and marginalized, they are never going to have a solution to their problem if we live in an individual rights-based regime, because just individual indigenous person by indigenous person has to come to court and claim their rights. That's never going to happen. So by thinking about human rights as a function of empowerment, then you will recognize that groups that have been deliberately subordinated will have something to say, and they will have, but the paradigm has to shift to allow that kind of thinking to take place. And if we're still stuck on the essentialist version of human rights, which is they're above politics, that you can't talk about these things as political realities, well, then the debate doesn't move. The balance doesn't, the rebalancing can't take place. So it's a way of thinking that has to change, and that once that way of thinking has changed, then the debate opens up to start talking about these things and thinking about solutions. I didn't quite understand the question from the young lady from Honduras about what rights were violated, except to say that, usually when some rights are violated, somebody else is exerting what they believe is their right. And so this is why in a society that's organized by laws and by courts and so on, this is usually the job of people that make decisions as to what right in this context is the one that needs to be honored more than the other right. It's the question of the context of the situation. What's more important? What values are being trampled on here or whatnot? I mean, I can think of the example of, let's say, someone's freedom of expression to encourage hatred against another group. Well, does their equality matter in terms of the person's freedom of expression? If engendering hatred against a specific group creates unrest in the society, creates violence, creates the desire for one group to do things, other unlawful things, well, perhaps then the freedom of expression of one person to encourage people to hate that members of that group should be limited. Those are the kinds of trade-offs that have to occur. And most countries of the world have those trade-offs within their constitutions. Most conventions have those trade-offs within them. They guarantee one freedom on the one hand, but they also guarantee other freedoms that may clash with those on the other. So the responsibility of decision-makers and adjudicators is to weigh those things. And so in your example, I'm not quite sure, because I didn't quite understand the context, how that would play out. I'm going to stop there, because there was a very complex question that I think you can answer far better than me on deconstruction. I don't even want to try that one.
Go ahead. More questions? No, maybe you want to, on the questions that were asked already. Yeah.
Well, the question by the colleague from Bosnia, I think we have to revise our conception of idealism and realism. I quite frankly think that to be realistic today is not to reduce reality to what exists. If you reduce reality to what exists, the end of history, and other theories like that, we end up absolutely trapped in a situation from which there is no exit for, millions and millions of people. We may be the little group that is relatively protective in this way. So I don't think it is idealistic. All the ideas start as utopia. The utopias have very different formulations. A great German philosopher, Ernst Bloch, discusses a lot why in the 18th century rights became more important than utopia as an aspiration, as an aspirational motive to better society. And of course he connects that with the individualism that was becoming rising and so on, and development in capitalism and liberalism and so on. But rights had an utopian side in it, and they should keep that. So I don't see the critical mass now to carry out this idea, but I can tell you something that, in fact, goes to the second question. The gentleman that asks us about the questions of nature as probably taking us back to the reactionary Russian mysticism. Well, I think that it is clear now, not just for First Nations, indigenous people, that this system of development has no future. There is a financial crisis, an economic crisis, an energetic crisis. We have seen Copenhagen. We are going to be in Cancun for another meeting. We have organized a summit of the people in Cochabamba. We have a declaration of Tiki Paya in Cochabamba showing that, in fact, we need a different model of development. This development exhausting the world, desertifying the world, is producing these answers from our Mother Earth, that answers that are not very pleasant to us. All these floods, all these tsunamis, all these contaminations of waters and so on. So I think that we know that something has to be done. But we don't know what and to what extent. This is a political process. As my colleague is telling you, we are really entering a very period of politicizing, repoliticizing human rights. And we have to add up, in my view, this human rights of nature, or the rights of nature, is an expansion that is necessary for the types of challenges that we have had. Of course, according for people, all of us, that were raised up in the conceptions of progress, development, modernization, the Russian thinking of the 19th century is reactionary. It has to. Tolstoy was considered reactionary. Rabindranath Tagore, the people of the jungle, reactionary. Read those books again. And if you read those books again, you see these guys had a point. A point that today, young people around the world fighting ecological struggles think that they have much more in common with these guys than they had with the industrialists of Manhattan of the beginning of the 20th century. So the world goes around and around. Old ideas that seem to be reactionary today are progressive, and the ideas that were reactionary or progressive today are sometimes reactionary. In fact, Marxism, like liberalism, has the same conception of nature. Yeah. You know, inexhaustible source, natural resource that we can exploit, torture. Bacon used to say we have to torture nature as we torture women to dominate them. That's Bacon. Francis Bacon. That's where the theory is about nature. Can we go on? So is Tolstoy reactionary vis-a-vis Bacon? Of course Bacon was the father of all the capitalist development. It is easy to know that he was on the side of progress. But today we have some doubts about the concept of progress itself. If progress leads us to what we are witnessing now, with so many people behind. And if they come to our progress, you know the United Nations study. If China is going to achieve the same level of development that we have in Europe and North America, we need three planets. The calculations are made by experts of the United Nations. Have you seen any politician caring about that? They want the Chinese to produce, buy automobiles, do things as we do. And then is irreversible after 2015, as the United Nations says. What can we do? I think that we are really at a time in which thresholds, limits have to be really put. This is very hard because we have been raised in the idea of the infinite growth, infinite progress, infinite knowledge, infinite by very finite human beings.
Maybe we have time for, I have 7 minutes left, so we have time for a few questions and comments. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to firstly thank both the young leaders and our wonderful speakers. There have been many messages that have come through your talks, and I think in your answers to some questions, you have slightly retracted from what sounded like a very postmodernist initial approach that they're, you know, human rights are in the eyes of the beholder. And I would have really liked to quote, I wish he was here now, Dapten Jinpa, who is the philosopher and translator for the Dalai Lama, who said how concerned he is to see the ease with which we are dismissing the essentialism of human rights as developed partially, one might say, from the Enlightenment, but certainly since the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I felt that, I must say, in your Declaration of Principles, that your concentration on diversity did seem to fail to understand how difficult it was to achieve the concepts of equality and liberty that were written into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I do understand that I'm coming from a different perspective, and you are young and moving forward, but just know what you give up is not always easily won back. So I want to really say that I do think that there are principles that are applicable to all persons who are disadvantaged, discriminated against, or deprived of the essentials of human dignity, of social and economic rights, and of equality. And that I don't think we should be losing sight of that. I agree with the analysis that, in fact, it's very hard to reach a common understanding which is universally applicable as to the value of those rights, the equality of women, the right of children not to be beaten by their parents, the right of homosexuals to live their lives the way they wish to. Yes, it is extremely hard to find a universal consensus on these things, and that is why the Universal Declaration is so precious. Because the Universal Declaration gives us a handle on an international level, a supranational and a supra-community level, to try and use these principles as education for those who do not accept them. The right to self-determination is written into the human rights regime. The right to protection of the environment is written into the human rights regime. I do think that there are very strong ideological challenges to human rights today. Not just the failure to implement human rights, but actually ideological challenges. And I think the Professor...
Souza Santos
certainly has identified the capitalist or the neoliberal challenge to human rights. Yeah. But it's not human rights that are lacking. It's the fact that they are being challenged by enormously powerful forces. And how do we tackle those forces? But it's not that the human rights regime has failed to articulate the need to give social and economic rights, the Millennium Goals, the development rights, all the right to clean water, all these things are written into the human rights vision and regime. That's on one hand. And on the other hand, when we talk the other ideological challenge to human rights is a religious challenge. Mm-hmm. There are religions which claim that their particular view of the world has a more authoritative source than the human rights community have, mm-hmm. or than human rights standards have. Mm-hmm. And that is an ideological challenge to human rights. So what I'm coming to ask you here is, how do we rescue, preserve, and value core human rights in spite of diversity? I'll add one last comment.
Quickly, because there are other people. One very quick comment.
I have over the years been in feminist conferences, and the move has been to stop talking about feminism and to talk about feminisms, that feminism doesn't apply to every different diverse group. And my argument has been, and I would say the same about human rights, there is a tree of feminism which all women in the world need to protect their human dignity. And on that tree there are branches of diverse needs of different groups of women in different society, in different societies. We shouldn't pull up the roots, because then the branches will wither in any case.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Quickly.
Yeah, okay. I just asked a question, but thank you for great conference and presentations. My question is very global, so I think it may be rhetorical, but it's been discussed through all the conference that human rights offer a contradict interest of the state. And sometimes it's like really rational interest of the state. You just mentioned today about strict policy on immigrants in Europe, and it's really against their human rights often, but also like it's a fact that Europe has huge problems with immigrants. Some of the immigrant community don't recognize the state, don't recognize the law in their country, and they don't want to integrate, and they don't want to work, so like they just live for payment from the government. So it's really rational from the state to restrict some immigrants from coming to country. So in this context, I just want to ask, is it possible to find some balance between human rights and this rational interest of the state? Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We'll take all the questions and comments, and then since we're at the end of our time, I'll ask both panelists for a final thought, 1 minute each. And we'll keep the questions and the comments that you're making now as food for thought. And you can come to see the panelists afterwards. So, Ludovic.
Yeah. Most of this conference has been about underlining the importance of critical human rights discourse and the importance of being sensitive to marginalized human rights narratives. Having studied human rights law in Beijing, I've seen how critical human rights discourse can be used sometimes as an excuse for human rights violations, ranging from the occupation for Tibet to the imprisonment of political dissidents. How can you reconcile your disgust for such situations and this sensitivity to their own human rights discourse?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. Thanks very much. I was a young leader in 2007, so it's great to come back and hear this. And to that, I just wanted to make the point about youth and youthfulness and how that can sometimes be deployed as discourse by experts. And I think that is sometimes a depoliticizing thing, or it can be. So I really enjoyed meeting some people today. And I think that the youthfulness is to be seen perhaps against an old age, not in an age sense. And I had a conversation over lunch about the age is your state of mind and your heart. So I think that needs to be kept alive, and I look forward to seeing people lead in this exciting time. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have a very quick response to the gentleman who asked the questions to young leaders. My answer would be that you believe in us, you trust in us, and you walk with us with whatever endeavors we have right now. So if you want to specifically support us, some of us has projects that they're ongoing towards committing human rights issues and everything, so you can meet us outside, and we will tell you exactly what you need to do.
She's from Afghanistan.
And my last question is, perhaps this question is not only for you guys here. If you wish to comment, you can. But perhaps this question is for all of us here. It seems like we are so caught up for the past decades about the conventions, about the theory, in the theories and the conventions and declaration of human rights. But what is left out is the people who are in the ground. Mm-hmm. So how can we go beyond declarations? How can we go beyond theories? How can we go beyond conventions and land to the hearts and lives of those people who are suffering right now?
Thank you. I will ask our two panelists for one final thought, 1 or 2 minutes each, before we have to conclude.
Do you want to go first? Okay, I'm just going to make it this very short. Francis, on your point of postmodern thought and whether there's been a retreat from our positions. I don't think so. I think I was quite clear in that. I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's been tremendously wonderful work done in developing standards and defining human behavior as respecting other people's rights and respecting dignity. What's lacking, though, and what I tried to get across was the way in which we think about it once that's done. And I think the young lady from Afghanistan here is putting her finger on that right now and saying, what about the people on the ground? All these discussions that these human rights careerists, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they're up there, they're at the UN, they're in universities and so on, but what about the real people who are suffering human rights violations day in and day out? And when human rights can get out of its formalistic way of looking at the world and looking at its function and get down to thinking about, well, this is really about people, this is really about power, it's about empowerment of people, it changes the way in which we think. And I think that Francis's metaphor is a very good one. You don't want to pull the tree up by the roots, but you also want that tree to flourish and grow. And not all branches are going to point in the same direction. Some branches are going to go in different directions to take into account their experience of where they are and the nourishment that they get and the support that they get and so on. And so there's a core minimum, of course, of human dignity rights. I remember my friend Catherine McKinnon used to say, a boot on the throat is a boot on the throat, no matter where you are in the world. And I always remember when Saddam Hussein was found in that little hole that he dug for himself and was discovered, first thing he said when he came up to fresh air was he wanted a lawyer. He wanted his rights respected. And throughout his trial, he kept arguing that he had his human rights had to be respected by the judge. So there are minimums that everybody recognizes, whether we in any particular area we recognize it or not. There's fundamental minimums that are there and that should stay there. What we don't have is the understanding from people that aren't heard what those rights mean to them and how they should be manifested in their reality and their context. And that's the missing part of all of this, is the human context, is the listening part, is the interpretation of those rights as they should be interpreted to serve the people that need them and want them. That would be my response to Francis's point on the core human rights values. Talked about state interest and immigrants. Often the state isn't the bad guy at all. States are often who we turn to protect our rights. I think that's a bit simplistic to think that human rights are always oppositional against the state. There's most of the economic, social, and cultural rights require state involvement. I think that, and then another reality of today is that really the state is less a human rights violator than all of the other private operators in the world, such as big business, such as technology, such as pharmaceutical companies and so on, that can have a huge impact for millions and millions of people by decisions that they make at their boardroom tables. Human rights violations are not at all just the purvey of states. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And so as the young man that was in Beijing, I mean, this is a variation on Francis Radé's point. When people use human rights discourse to justify their violations of human rights, that's when they must be called on that, because those core values are being polluted and corrupted by that kind of usage. And if people are fully understanding of what human rights are and believe in the core values, then they can be in a position to say, that's absolutely wrong, and there should be no embarrassment in saying that, whether you're a country or an individual or you're an NGO or whatever you are. And that core understanding has to be there. So guess in conclusion on this point, there's core values that mustn't change, that are minimum, that we have to respect, but we also have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't have all the answers. We don't know how all these rights necessarily play out in different people's lives and experiences, and especially people who need them the most. So we have to continue working on the branches, leave the trunk of the tree where it is.
Well, there is not such a thing called human rights on one side and liberalism and capitalism on the other side. They are part of the same thing. They are part of the same package. And, of course, full of contradictions, very dynamic. And it is this dynamic and this contradiction that explains us why certain advances are possible, certain progresses are possible in human rights and not in other cases. In some cases, we progress. We have advanced, in others we don't. So that's precisely because of the same package. And that's why, at this point, it is probably convenient, not just for the China, but also for the Western world, that the current version of capitalism in China does not allow for even minimal human rights. Of course, we know all the talk about the Asian conception of human rights. We have written books, we have seen books about that, Confucius' conception of human rights. But what is at the core at this point is a brutal, savage form of capitalism. And in fact, the West is indulgent with that because China is supporting the United States, is supporting our Western economies. And that's why we have this cynicism of critical engagement with them. And that's why I think that if you go to China and, in fact, work with critical people there, the critical human rights, I could give you some references of human rights activists in China, and they are very critical of the Western conceptions, as the women, Muslim women throughout the world, are very critical of the Western conceptions of human rights, but they have their own conceptions. The problem is that each culture is dynamic, and in each culture you see movement, for instance, the rights of women. They don't need the West to tell them that. They are doing that from inside out. And you can see that in many, many ways. And I've worked with Muslim women, Kuala Lumpur, in which there is nothing Western about their conceptions. But their conceptions fight for the same rights and for the same aspiration of Western women through their own ways. The migrants, well, it's I, with full respect, it's a caricature of the Roma people or other people that don't respect the state. There are different ways of belonging to a state. The people, the Roma people that were just expelled from France, they were camping there. They were, some of them were very stable there. They pay their taxes in informal economy very often. Informal economy because informal economy is growing. They are not particularly delinquent. There is nothing that justifies this attitude. I think that the state is doing that because they don't belong. They are there because they are brute force of production. If we don't need them at the time, expel them. We don't care. We do that the same way you contaminate rivers. I mean, they are discardable people. That's the way we deal with these people. There is no defense whatsoever on doing what we are doing, at least in Europe, with migrants, and I would say in southern border of the United States, we could find the same, and in many other places, we could find the same.
Well, we're coming to the end of this conference, and I'm not going to even think of trying to summarize what we've done in the past 3 days. Just a few words on what I take out of this conference. We did not try to find solutions. We mostly tried to untangle complex factual situations and complex conceptual frameworks. Simply acknowledging the complexity, the messiness, as it was said, of the relationship between law, power, and social diversity, and exploring it thoroughly, as we've done, is an essential contribution, especially when we are quite often facing a political elite or the media as they try to find simple solutions to oversimplified issues. They are simplifying the issue to be able to produce a simple answer for the next election or for the next news show. And it was possible to do this because of one characteristic of the format of this conference, which was a gathering of policymakers, civil society, politicians, professionals, academics, and the important voice of the youth. We came from very different perspectives, and we didn't agree on everything. We didn't have to either. One of the things we did, I think, and it came up in so many panels, was to question some entrenched distinctions that we're making between what we term polar opposites, where it's all black and white. And what we have done was to explore the middle ground, the spectrum between the polar opposites, and see the richness of that spectrum. And the opposites were universality and locality, universality and relativism, modernity and tradition, developed and developing, religious and secular, reality and rhetoric, and then north and south, west and east. These concepts, which were born in other era, change content, but they are still talking to us. Objects and subjects, abstraction and concrete realities, security and freedom, individuality and solidarity, universal and foundational, domination and subordination, victims and agents, and tonight or this afternoon, human and biosphere. We have often defined all these as polar opposites between we have to choose, when in fact the reality is much richer and there's a lot in between. And the relationships between the opposites or the polar opposites is extremely rich. And there were common themes. I haven't been able, like none of us, we don't have the power of ubiquity, I haven't been able to go to all the panels. But from the panels I've been to, there were common themes. And these common themes, and a few common themes could be simply the adequacy of our current conceptual human rights frameworks. They have been questioned in all the panels, and again here at this stage here this afternoon. The role of context, of contextualizing in defining, implementing, problematizing, and enforcing human rights. The efficacy of narratives, of storytelling, of asking people to tell what they live in order to entangle the knot of nuanced issues at the core of human rights struggles. The significance, this was mentioned in the early beginning, and it's kept in my mind, and I tried to apply it to several of the ideas that came up, the significance of dialogic justice, dialogic engagement with rights holders, with people, with the downtrodden, with people who live lives with human rights violation. So I think these are common threads that we could find in many of the panels. And only through a thorough analysis, an open dialogue, a particular attention paid to the details of human lives as they are lived, and this was mentioned very recently this afternoon, a real listening to those who are not heard, can we really achieve a better understanding of the complex struggle for dignity that we have all been talking about for 3 days? And then, and maybe then only, can calls for action, can they be heard? Can they have a meaning? Because we understand much better the complexity. And only then, maybe, can we start to make a difference. I would like to thank, that's where we're at now, all the speakers for their magnificent contributions, their thoughtful contributions. I would like to thank and the young leaders and welcome them in the group of the McGill Eckenberg Human Rights Fellows. They have predecessors and they will have successors, and the group will grow. Your dynamism, your energy, your imagination have infused the whole conference, and we trust that your future realizations will meet your dreams, since you've started with a dream catcher. There will be a conference volume, and I hope that I can count on all the presenters for a written contribution for the volume in order to ensure an enduring legacy to this conference. You can watch this whole conference on the internet. It'll be posted somewhere. Don't ask me where, but it'll be posted somewhere, and through the website of the conference, it'll be accessible. Don't hesitate to use it as a pedagogical tool. This conference was the second in a series. There will be a third. And we would be, and I'm sure Penny and Gordon would be, delighted to receive ideas as to what the theme of the next conference should be. We have to start thinking about it. I would like to thank again, as the young leaders did just before, but I add my thanks to Penny and Gordon Eckenberg for their generosity, for their vision, which inspire and make possible the realization of this conference series and of this, what I think was a magnificent conference. I would like to thank Nandini and her team for the daily miracles to which they have presided with the organization of this conference. I thank you all for being here. I trust that we all come out of this conference better informed, certainly it's inspired and energized. I hope to see you in 2012 for the next McGill-Eckenberg Conference on Human Rights, and I wish you a good evening.